nice tick tick boom swag.
Yeah, I'm wearing my Tick Tick Boom sweatshirt, and my this was a little bit of free swag given me by just the studio. You know, critics get this sort of free swag all the time.
Did it come before or after your review?
I think it came before I reviewed it, but after I saw it, which I know is like maybe a little bit suspicious. I'll have you know that when it comes to compromising my integrity as a critic, it's going to take a heck of a lot more than a sweatshirt to get me to give a positive review. I was actually talking about this with William, my co-host over on the Critically Acclaimed Network. Like, where is our line? What's our line? How much would we compromise for? And, you know,
right?
Because surely we have one. We would, like... Because
is it 6 months rent?
Like it's not 6 months rent. I would not violate my my integrity for 6 months rent. But you know, if somebody's going to offer me $500 million, okay, I would be compromising my integrity as a critic. I would be drummed out of the industry. I wouldn't be able to work as a critic ever again. But think how comfortable I would be. Okay.
But then after the income taxes, how comfortable would you be?
Oh, well, I'm assuming in this fantasy scenario I'd have, like, an overseas bank account or something really shady, so I'd be able to hang on to all of this.
Right, well, you would be a multi-millionaire at that point, so the rules wouldn't apply to you anymore, so.
That's right.
yeah. speaking of, I just wanted to talk to you about this, just speaking of, like, integrity or whatever, can we just talk about the Lynn Sachs episode that we did?
The episodes, plural? That was wild. I love talking with Lynn Sachs on our last two episodes. There are some people who just make me burn with envy. And there are the people who, like, start out as wanting to be great artists as young people and then just are. Like, the people who seek out to live an artistic life and do. And that's sort of a life I never really had my druthers to pursue. So, of course, I burn with envy when I hear these stories of the people who, you know, went to college to become artists or dropped out of college to sort of live an artistic life and made it work. Because there are so many stories of people who do that and don't make it work and have to, you know, take a real job, right, for instance. Real job, I say, that is a non-artistic job, in order to, quote, sell out. And how refreshing to talk to Lynn Sachs, who has been kind of living that dream and constantly looking at the world in a fascinating from a fascinating artistic viewpoint.
Right. I mean, I just, because looking, as I was, you know, listening back and editing it and everything, I was just like, I felt kind of, I don't know, was I being like, you know, like overly effusive and just like, you know, like as you said, like trying to ingratiate myself and all this stuff. And I mean, I was talking about this with Bibbs on Wednesday, because Wednesday was my birthday, and my Bibbs's birthday present to me was we had a 90-minute chat.
Aww.
About life affirming films, and one of those films we'll be talking about today. Anyway, and I just asked him, he's like, well, one, it's your first interview that you've ever done, so cut yourself some slack.
I would say that you availed yourself quite well.
I mean, I did do the research.
I guess more than you put me to shame, so I was a far tertiary member of that conversation.
Right, but I feel like I was very glad that you were there, because you did the thing that you talk about being good at doing, is that, you know, you listen to them and then you ask them a question based on what they just said, where I feel like I was kind of I was just kind of like, okay, let's move on and talk about, you know, try to at least talk about this other film. I did it more gracefully sometimes than others, but anyway, just, yeah, that was what a wonderful episode that was.
Yeah, and
that was a highlight.
It helped that, sure, I was really,
this whole podcast.
It helped that I think we were both really kind of enamored of Lynn Sachs' work. It wasn't one of those things where, right, we're going to talk to Lynn Sachs and ask very dry questions about sort of technical things that they might have done and try to avoid talking about our opinions of the thing, mm-hmm. which, you know, luckily in, you know, the case of All About Ovid here, you have sort of the leeway to seek out the things you're more passionate about. Whereas, right. Sometimes when you're writing for an outlet and you're assigned an interview, you don't necessarily like it. Case in point, I'm going to be starting up a new regular writing gig over at Slash Film pretty soon. And
congrats.
Thank you. I'm going to have an actual full-time writing gig for the first time in my life. That'll be fun. All I can think is, how am I going to screw this up? But one of my first interviewing assignments over there is going to be with a filmmaker named Michael Bay. And Michael Bay, known for a small intimate art pictures like Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. And
oh, no.
And, you know, that'll be a fascinating interview because I
just, you know what you need to do is you need to only talk about about like Criterion and like how like the
well, you know what,
like how does it feel being one of the first people to get two films in the Criterion collection?
You know what, I can ask about that. What are his favorite Criterion films? What sort of films is he passionate about? If he hadn't become a cottage industry of like making these big dumb action pictures, what kind of filmmaker would he be? I want to know what kind of artist Michael Bay could be. That's what
talk
I want to talk about.
Yeah, what are his favorite Criterion releases? What are his favorite art house movies? That's what I want to hear about.
I mean,
is he secretly a huge fan of Ozu?
That would like, be, yeah, I would love to talk with Michael Bay about Ozu. I know, I mean, you can tell if you watch his movies that he's a big fan of the Coens.
He's half of their cast in their movies.
Yeah, he's you know, Malkovich and Francis McDormand are in his movies. When he wanted to make his own passion project, he wanted to make this like quirky crime comedy called Pain and Gain, which doesn't resemble anything like a Coen Brothers movie, but like that's kind of where what he was trying to do with a movie like that. So there are things to talk about with someone like Michael Bay, even if I kind of loathe his films. So there's always going to be a conversation to be had.
Yeah.
I just hope he doesn't put me on the spot and ask me what I think of Transformers 4, because I saw that movie and which one is the one with the dinosaur robots in it? I even forgot.
Transformers 4 Revenge of, no.
No, wait.
Age of Extinction.
That was it. Age of Extinction, the fourth one, which is like 2 hours and 45 minutes in length. After the screening of that movie, I left the screening room on the Paramount lot, walked over to a public fountain that they had on the lot, and I just put my hands in the water just because I needed that kind of cleansing experience to sort of rid all of that chaos from my brain. If I want chaos, I want it to be a defiant chaos, and if I am not in a chaotic mood, I want something a little bit sort of real and grounded and calming, which was my clever way of segueing into this week's films that I've seen, or this month's films that I've seen on Ovid.
Okay, well, here's the thing, Whitney. If I may walk your segue back a bit, because I've got a couple more things I want to talk to you about up front.
I was so witty about it, welcome, but go ahead.
Good evening, welcome to All About Ovid, Ovid with an O, All with the O. My name is Peter's host, Whitney Seibold.
Hello.
People, we do this thing. I'm just kind of wanting to purge like all of the thoughts over the last month that has happened since we recorded our podcast with Lynn Sachs.
Oh, yes.
Just because it's been kind of a big month. I wanted to add, you saw Sparks in concert? Did I see that right?
I did. I saw Sparks in concert. Thanks to that documentary that Edgar Wright made. They're sort of very much back in the public eye, and they got a new tour. So I got to see the first night of their new tour at the Walt Disney Hall in downtown Los Angeles. My wife and I were in the very back row, but the cool thing about the Walt Disney Hall, it was designed by architect Frank Gehry, and he designed it in such a way that there's no bad seats in the house. Like, everybody kind of has a good view of the stage. There's nothing obstructed. Seats aren't in front of other seats. It's really well designed. So even though we were in the back row, we had a good show nonetheless.
Okay. Just because I saw that and I was like, well, because I also went to a couple live shows myself, like some of my first.
Oh, okay. Tell me.
At the beginning of February. And one of my, you know, my grandparents' birthday present to me was they got me tickets to see Mike Birbiglia, who is one of, if not my favorite stand-up comedian. And we went down to Portland because he that was where the show was anyway. And so we went to, and we drove, got in at like 6 p.m. and the show was at 9:30 and we were going to have dinner, my dad and I. And across the street from Mike Birbiglia was Tig Notaro.
Sweet.
And there were tickets left. And there were good tickets left. Yeah. And so we saw Tig Notaro and it was amazing.
That's so wonderful. Oh, I'm jealous.
So that was my first, I got my first live comedy show, and it turned out to be my first two live comedy shows back to back.
Wow.
And Tig Notaro was spectacular. I cannot wait for if a special comes out or whatever for her tour. It's called Hello Again. Like, it's just, oh my word. I was always skeptical about comedy shows. It's like, do people really laugh? Because I feel like, because when I'm watching them at home, like, I will laugh, but I don't laugh that hard and for that long. And like, do people actually laugh like that? Or are they like, you know, just hyped up and it's like editing and stuff? No, you can actually laugh that hard that long. And it was just a riot. Oh. And I want to shout out the opener for Mike Birbiglia, Atsuko Akatsuka. She is a great up-and-comer. She's amazing. She has a thing. She was on James Corden's show, and she had a, you know, like 11-minute set or whatever. And so you can watch that. But her opener for Mike Birbiglia was spectacular. And I ended up forgetting that I was there to see Mike Birbiglia because she was so good. Anyway, live shows. Also, I've just seen a boatload of amazing first time like watches this month, including The Birds I saw for the first time this month, and that is the first film to ever actually scare me, like actually like get a scream out of me.
All right, nice.
I saw Moonstruck.
That's a sweet movie.
Is a perfect movie. It is amazing. Went back and listened to your review because you watched it for like the streaming club like back in 2020, and you thought that Nick Cage might have been miscast and that Stallone would have been a better choice. And I say no to you, that Nicolas Cage was perfect.
And the character is depicted as sort of a meathead. I was trying to think who's like an Italian meathead. Well, Stallone is an Italian meathead. That's kind of what he's known for.
Right, but I lost my hand. I lost my wife. He has his hand. He has his wife. Like, are you kidding? It's the best. I saw Fishing with John, like the whole series for the first time, and that was lovely.
Yeah, I love Fishing with John.
Saw Robert Altman's Three Women the other night.
Okay.
And that was wild. I saw Carell, which is Rainer Werner Fassbinder's final film.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And this is fun, for my birthday, I bought myself a 1982 Andy Warhol poster for Rainer Werner Fassbinder's Carell.
Ooh, all right.
And so that's on its way. And anyway, so I've got like, yeah, like a mint condition 1982 print of the Warhol's poster for Carell. And it's a gorgeous piece of art.
Is that the one with the big phallus on it?
It's not that poster. Okay. That is a poster that for Carell, but it's specifically Andy Warhol's screen printing poster, and it's two men and one's licking the back of the other's ear.
Okay.
And
hold on, let me I've got my computer up here. I got to look up. Oh, okay. I haven't seen that poster before. That's great.
It's pretty gorgeous.
Yeah.
I also, for Valentine's Day, by accident, just watched David Lean's Brief Encounter.
That's a sweet one.
Yeah, and I was just, I thought it was like, I went going in, I like, the only thing I know David Lean is Dr. Zhivago and Bridge on River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia, so I was like, this is going to be maybe some thriller or something, and no, it's just the sweetest affair movie you've ever seen. Yeah, so that was great. And then I saw Testament of Orpheus, finally, which is easily my favorite of the Orpheus trilogy.
Okay. I think I prefer Blood of a Poet. I just sort of like the strangeness of that movie, but
Okay. That's probably my least favorite of the three, just because, like, that one took me, like, 2 or 3 tries to get through,
okay.
even though it's the shortest.
It's, like, an hour long. It's pretty brief.
Yeah. And then one last thing before we finally get into the movies. I woke up, like, an hour ago.
Oh.
Because yesterday I drove down to Oregon to see some friends for my birthday, and I left their house at 12:15 in the morning and drove 4.5 hours back home.
Oh gosh!
I drove through the night.
And you made it. That's grateful.
Oh yeah, I find driving through the night to be way easier than driving through the day. It's no cars. It's a lot quieter. I for some reason I find it way easier to stay awake at night driving than during the day for whatever reason. But anyway, and just it's I just need to this feeling of I haven't seen these people. The last time I saw this like friend group was New Year's of 2020, when we all thought that the world was going to continue to be somewhat normal. And it was wild because we were all, you know, like 2 years younger then, and we hung out and it was kind of like old times, but it also wasn't because we were all adults now. And it was like the first time hanging out with friends as adults and talking about, you know, like our lives and like people's jobs that we have now, and like we've moved out. I have not. I'm trying anyway. And it was just a really kind of wild experience, and like just and also talking about like and there's a war in Ukraine, which I woke up to texts from friends who have been living in Ukraine for the past few years, and they spent 15 hours on foot at the border waiting to get out into Poland, and they managed to get there.
Oh, good. Okay.
But also we have friends who like are Ukrainian, and they are trying to hide out in bunkers, and it's scary. But anyway, this is all to say that I wrote a poem. Last night.
Just in response to all the chaos and the fear and the war.
Well, just in response to this feeling of just, you know, realizing that I'm an adult now, because I'm like, I'm 21 now. And
welcome to the other side.
Yeah, and like there's no more like you're an officially you are no longer a minor by any definition. You are an adult.
I'll say this. You still can't rent a car by yourself, and you get...
That's true, which is weird.
You're 25, and you can't run for president. You can't run for president until you're 35. That's the age limit.
Not really planning on it, but on that one. But anyway, I wrote a poem last night, and I just kind of wanted to read it to you, because you're an appreciator of poetry.
I love a good poem.
So I write poems on napkins when I'm like out at dinner, and I call them napkin poems. And so they're always short because they have to fit on a napkin. So this is the poem. It's just titled February 24th, 2022, which is yesterday. Birthday sushi with friends I haven't seen since the world ended. We used to be totally uninterested in old people with a living. And now we're old people with or without a living. Grown up, grown apart, grown away, grown into specifics. A preschool teacher's assistant who's trying not to date. An unemployed college dropout who's seen the world. A barista who goes to work at 4 a.m. A proud atheist gay man who left us. That's the poem.
It's very... I haven't met those people, but... You've evoked them.
That's the other thing is like in the last 2 years, two of my best friends have cut me out of their life, and so anyway. So that was also part of the weird thing is just like hanging out and realizing that there are people who aren't with us anymore. Like, yeah, they're yeah. alive, but they're just not a part of our lives anymore, which is weird.
You'll hear a lot of stories as you get older about how difficult it is to not just make friends, but maintain adult friendships as you get older. And the way you relate to people right. in your teens is different than the way you relate to people when you're in your 20s. And right. you're, I mean, because yeah. you become different people and you grow and you develop different interests, you start to realize that people are forging their lives on their own rather than forging their lives mm-hmm. with you as part of their circle. And that's not a difficult realization, but it is a big, it's just a big part of growing up. It's a big part of getting older. And yeah. it only becomes more starkly contrasted the older you get.
Yeah, it's just it's been a big month of realizing that yeah, life is never gonna be the same.
Well, but that's true every day. You know, life isn't the same when you're 10 as it is when you were when you were 6 or 7. You know, what the old saying about the only constant being change is constantly proves to be true. And yet you're always the same person, which is kind of unusual.
Speaking of we will never be the same, you saw Fresh Kill.
I did see Fresh Kill.
Let's finally get to the movies now.
Okay.
21 minutes into the podcast.
You know what? People are here to hear us converse. They're here to listen to poetry. Ovid is about films about life. And so here we are playing into... Look, I don't know. I'm BSing here. But let's get to the movies anyway. Yes, I saw Fresh Kill, the 1994 film, which you previously saw, and when you described it, it was one of those "where has this film been all my life" kind of moments, mm-hmm. Because this is one I should have seen in 1994 when it came out, and
it
would have been my thing, and it just somehow is out of my experience, and I finally in 2022 caught up with Fresh Kill, and yeah. This film is my fucking jam. I love this thing. just in premise alone, but in execution as well. The premise is wonderfully, totally bizarre. It's about a lesbian couple who are raising a young daughter right next to a landfill in New York. Like, they live next right. to...
In Staten Island.
Staten Island. And they, like... The dump is, it looks a lot like certain scenes from the movie They Live, because there's a lot of people living in the dump, and there's stacks of TVs. There's all this imagery of poisonous media sort of leaking throughout this movie, and you know, it's kind of exemplified by this wall of televisions in a dump, and they salvage things out of the dump, and they go home, and they have conversations, and they have a lot of sex. And
they, with an accordion.
Yeah,
like, there is
there's a cunnilingus like, slash accordion scene.
Yeah,
where one of these women is playing the accordion while climaxing. It's pretty brilliant, and one of them works as a waitress at this like ultra hip sushi restaurant, and I'm old enough to remember when sushi first became sort of this cultural marker in the United States, kind of in the mid-1980s. If you watch the film The Breakfast Club, the sort of rich girl character in that movie, played by Molly Ringwald, eats sushi, and everybody kind of looks at her sideways. That's really weird, eating like raw fish and rice wrapped in seaweed. Why are you eating that? That's so strange, because it was seen as this... like rich person's food. It was high class food. Now sushi is incredibly common and everybody's eating sushi. You can get sushi in Kansas now.
I literally had it last
time. Oh, there you go. so the sushi restaurant as a setting is meant as sort of a class signifier in Fresh Kill. And the kinds of people who are still going to these sushi restaurants are like insufferable Wall Street yuppie types who are just talking about right. big
and
deals.
They love the fish lips, but the fish are poisoned, man.
Yeah, that's how snotty they are. They'll only eat the lips. The fish is all tainted with... this bizarre magical alien radiation, which when somebody eats it, they like glow green and then they vanish in this like weird kind of like streak of supernatural sci-fi thing that's going on. And they
and this all takes place in like a near future.
Like
it's cyberpunk.
And there's a lot of hacking going on. And this is 1994 when hacking was still a bit of a novelty. It's like, oh, I can hack into stuff. If you remember in Jurassic Park,
and then have sex in a bathtub.
Yeah, we're gonna hack and have sex. And it was essentially an early example of cyberpunk on film. You know, the next year the movie Hackers would come out and sort of do a kind of a much more contrived version of the same thing. But yeah, for a while there, hacking was considered this truly like anti-establishment activity where you're going to break into banks and just sow chaos. And Fresh Kill is tapping into that in a science fiction setting. So there's a character in it who is constantly wandering through a grocery store and sort of absorbing the grossness of consumer culture, and everybody's being driven mad by all of this choice of consumer products. And he's also a hacker, and this all involves using the hacking talents and the tainted meat to expose this evil corporation who's polluting the oceans, and using the tainted fish to essentially control the minds of the yuppies. Golly, what a cool thing. And it's really, really short.
Meanwhile, the couple, you know, their child, like, seems to just vanish and disappear because of this radiation. And so a lot of the film is dedicated to them trying to find her.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has a really sweet resolution that I don't want to give away.
It does have a sweet resolution. It's really, really short, but they cram a lot into this thing.
It's chock full of stuff.
It's just every scene is just loaded with incident and a lot of bizarre imagery. The director, Xu Lia Chiang, she had partly real settings in New York, but a lot of the interiors were very, like, aggressively artificial sets with this, like, kind of weird stylized stark lighting. You were talking about the accordion. There's a whole pile of accordions. Just in a room somewhere. There's just, like, a pile of stuff, and it's meant to sort of read as this kind of artistic installation. So a lot of the sushi restaurant doesn't appear to have walls. It's sort of set in this big kind of black warehouse space. All the lighting is really stark and colored. It has this kind of wonderful theatrical quality to it, where you feel like parts of it you're watching this play. It reminded me a lot. It reminded me a lot of. It's sort of like a more impish, satirical version of Lizzie Borden's Born in Flames, which we've talked about before.
Yeah. Yeah, it does bear a lot of similarities.
Queer sci-fi, tech-based anti-establishment film, like science fiction parable. A very small genre, but one that I'm very fond of. Mm-hmm.
There's also the way that Chiang kind of plays with the concept of race in the film, which, I mean, I'm not super qualified to talk about, but like the lesbian couple it's a white woman who has a black mother who is like this television personality, and then a woman who is half Indian and half American Indian, and so there's all of these ways that like just implicitly like this implicit commentary on race, anyway, there's pieces that I read about it which can say more about it than I can.
The handling of race is actually, I think it's one of the clumsier elements of Fresh Kill, because they don't really address it directly or talk about it in any kind of like practical terms. It's just sort of an element of it that I feel like they don't really get into quite enough or in quite the right way.
All right.
But yeah, Xu Lia Chiang was born in Taiwan. She's an American artist, and she's made a couple other movies that I'm not at all familiar with. Fresh Kill was the only one I had heard of. Let me look up the titles of her other films. She did a film called IKU, which was like sci-fi porn, evidently. And yeah, she did a few other, and she did two other features sort of about sex and gender a little bit more recently. And yeah, I'd be interested to sort of see her work as an artist, just because I think she is very fond of this weird sort of cyberpunk sci-fi aesthetic that is, you know, incredibly appealing to me. But I don't know where to find these movies. Just there, I think they play in museums.
Right, exactly. Like, yeah. But just thank you to Ovid for giving us not one, but two films that center accordions that are just brilliant, between Fresh Kill and Too Late to Die Young.
Oh, God, that's right. There was a lot of accordions in Too Late to Die Young. Yeah. By the way, if you're a new listener, we
Eternal Flame, was that the song that Sophia performed at for like New Year's? And yeah, just it's all centered around her performance of this song on this song cover on accordion. Speaking of music, I saw Johnny Toe's Office. This is Johnny Toe is a filmmaker that I'd never heard of until like this year, in which he's getting like a film released on the Criterion. Called Throwdown, and or it might already be in the collection, I don't remember, but anyway, this is his musical. It's a Taiwanese musical, and it's set in did you see Clouds of Sils Maria, the Olivier Assayas film?
I have the video. Okay. And I haven't watched it yet.
Okay, so just then at the end of that film, they're putting on a play that Juliette Binoche is in. And the set is this bare set that is, all of the rooms are just like these steel, like cube, like hollow cubes. It's just like frames. And then they're lit by these light bars. Mm-hmm. And so it's this very, it's like more set dressing than Dogville, but it's still like clearly just an artificial set that you can see through. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's what Johnny Toe's Office is set in. It's this huge set in a warehouse of this office building, and it's all just stainless steel bars and light bars, and it's just this kind of abstract, modern, very artificial set, and it's this ensemble cast, including Chow Yun-fat, who plays the CEO of this corporation. Mm-hmm. And it's about and it's set in 2008. Can you guess what's going to happen at the midpoint climax of the movie? And it's about this ensemble of characters. And this specifically these two new interns, essentially, or they're just starting out. One is Li Jiang, who Li for Ang Lee, Jiang for Dream, which he repeats ad nauseum throughout the film. He's this very optimistic, like, I'm gonna be the best guy. I'm gonna be best at my job ever. I love corporate culture. And then you have this woman who is secretly the CEO's daughter. And she wants to get in on her own without people knowing, so it's not like this nepotism thing. And over the course of the film, there's drama and romance and failed romance, and the recession happens, and people get in trouble. And here's the thing, is that that's the entire movie. There's not a lot here. It's for the first half, you think, is this just a movie that's just kind of celebrating office culture? Because there doesn't seem to be really any critique of it. Hmm. It's just a musical set in an office building. Hmm. And then the recession hits, and the mood changes. It gets a lot darker, like, actually, literally. Like, the film goes from a lot of light grays and whites to a lot of dark grays and blacks, which is kind of neat. Mm-hmm. Characters get deeper and deeper, dig deeper and deeper holes for themselves, and some of them meet, you know, bad endings, but also the film ends in this resolution where it's going to be okay. Hmm. And it feels a bit like, well, hold on, what are we saying here? Like the person who has the worst ending of any of the characters is like the one person who did a bad thing, and then one other person went to jail, but then everyone else is fine and we're going to pull through. And it's just this weird attitude about corporate culture that seems to be like, essentially, like pretty much is like, yeah, we might have our bad apples, but really it's worth it to try and keep this culture alive.
Hmm.
Kind of deal. It's a little odd. I didn't really like know how I felt about it in terms of its message. But also, the most annoying thing about the film, and it's not the film's fault, but it is whoever distributed it, is the subtitles.
Okay.
This is a musical.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a musical that's in either Mandarin or Cantonese. I can't tell the difference. Forgive me. And first of all, like I said, a lot of the first half of this film is like lots of light grays and whites, and the subtitles are just little tiny, they're very small on the screen, and they're also just white words, like with no like black edging.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times it's difficult to even read the subtitles because they'll blend in with the white backgrounds and you just can't read them. Secondly, it's a musical and the lyrics don't rhyme. I know this is a thing that can be really hard to do. The original English release or English subtitles for Cleo from 5 to 7, the song numbers didn't rhyme. And then in the new restoration that Criterion just did, they do rhyme. And so this is like a thing that you can kind of go either way on. But when it's a musical and none of the lyrics rhyme and the meter's all over the place in every single line because it's different because of translation, it becomes really hard to get into the music, mm-hmm. like, and actually what they're saying.
Hmm.
And then thirdly, there are a lot of duets in the film.
Uh-huh.
And the subtitles, when this happens, will only translate one of the person's lines. And you don't know who is singing.
That's frustrating. The subtitles. Okay.
And in terms of the music itself, it's pleasant and enjoyable to listen to. The duets in particular, I really enjoyed, but I only knew what one of the persons was saying, and I didn't always know who was saying it.
Hmm.
So it was a pleasant experience, but also that was kind of. But it was also kind of frustrating. And mm-hmm. at the end of it, I was like, I'm not sure what I totally got out of this other than Chow Yun-Fat is good looking.
I mean, sometimes that can be enough. I feel like there was a time when I had a little bit more of a mercenary view about subtitles. I would see anything with subtitles, even if I couldn't read them. I sometimes liked seeing older prints. Like if you see an old Tarkovsky movie, it's, you know, in Russian with English subtitles, white subtitles against a snowy background. You can read nothing. So you're just watching a film in Russian. And your experience of watching a film that way is, of course, going to be very, very different. And I think...
Right.
You enter a different sort of headspace when you watch a film where you can't really read the subtitles because you start trying to see what you can read through just things like the visuals and the acting and not the dialogue. That can be, I think, a legitimate film experience unto itself. You know, if you're ever traveling abroad and you go to a movie theater where they don't typically subtitle a film in English or dub it into another language, sometimes you just watch it in another language and you try to sort of intuit what you can get out of it. You might not understand the story or like what's happening in a certain emotional scene, but you do get something a little bit more raw. Maybe you could, you know, at least appreciate the tunes of the musical and the rawness of the acting and still have a pleasant film experience out of it.
Right. And I still enjoyed myself. It just, there was this continually this kind of frustrating thing.
Yeah.
That it was just like, I'm trying to understand what they're saying, and either I can't read the subtitles, or the subtitles maybe aren't the best translations, and also they're not translating half of the songs in the duet numbers. So it's just, yeah. Also, I just want to take this opportunity, and we gush about Ovid a lot, obviously, because we really love it. But I just want to say this. I don't know if this is for legal reasons or why this is, but it kind of... I don't really like how I feel about when you go... Ovid has this thing where you can go and search movies by country.
Yeah.
And they, in their China collection, they have films from Tibet and Hong Kong and Taiwan in their China collection, which I just feel iffy about. I don't really like that.
I'm no expert in international policy, but I do know that China is really tetchy about how you refer to their territories, and it's entirely possible that Ovid would not be able to get films from any of China or any of those areas if they listed them as separate countries, because technically they're not, and China doesn't want you to say that they are. I remember this made sort of like the late night comedian circuit for a while when John Cena had to apologize for referring to Taiwan as a country when it, you know, according to China, isn't.
And yeah, then he spoke in like really fluently.
Yeah, like he spoke he gave the apology in like pretty good Mandarin. It's like,
yeah,
okay. John Cena's a really interesting guy, isn't he? I suspect he's bisexual because he's constantly playing bisexual characters. Interesting. But like a Peacemaker is bisexual. If you saw the
I haven't seen it. I've only heard like really good things about it, but at the same time, I saw the Suicide Squad, and that dude's just a fascist. Fascist. Like,
I think the function of the show is to, like,
I don't know if I want to watch a show about a fascist.
Ah, but he's a bisexual fascist.
That doesn't make him not a fascist.
But in the Amy Schumer film, Trainwreck, he plays a guy who's dating Amy Schumer, but he's constantly talking about, like, hooking up with other guys, like, inadvertently. Like, hey, I'm going to fight you. I'll meet you on Grindr. Like, that sort of thing. But yeah, I think that John Cena aside, I think that might be technically, politically, those territories are part of China. So they're going to be listed as Chinese films. I think they're just trying to do the proper thing.
My guess is that it's a legal thing, because they're getting these from distributors, obviously, and it might be just in the text is like, hey, let's not risk it, essentially.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And it just kind of bums me out because obviously of everything that is happening right now. Like, we don't know what's next if this precedent is, now that this precedent has been set.
How long before we're getting Ukrainian films that are listed as Russian films, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so anyway, speaking of films that are under the China banner, even though they were not technically made in China itself proper, we saw a Hong Kong film.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also one of the just blow away amazing films that I saw this month. A Simple Life is amazing.
This was one of those films that was on a lot of critics' top 10 lists back when it came out in 2011. I remember a lot of critics talking about it, and it was
Roger Ebert, I think, specifically was like really big on it.
Yeah, and they, it earned a lot of awards in Hong Kong, and it was, topping a lot of critics' lists, and then it, like, passed through Los Angeles in 3 days and then was gone, so I never had a chance to see it. Until now, thanks to Ovid. This is one of those films where you don't realize how deeply you're feeling it until very late in the movie. Because it's called A Simple Life, and it is about just sort of life lived. It's a very, it's not melodramatic. It's a very, not really kitchen sink realism, but is a realist drama about a relationship between the two main characters. There's Andy Lau. He plays a character named Roger. And his rich family's longtime maid and chef and cook.
She's been working for 60 years and four generations.
Yeah, so she raised Roger. She's essentially like a second mom to him. She goes by Otto. She's played by an actress named Deanie Ip, who was just showered with awards for this movie.
And deservedly so. Like, honestly, like, I went back and I looked at the Oscars celebrating the films of 2011, and I'm like, I'm sorry, John Dujardine. Andy Lau deserves this.
Oh, gosh. And,
yeah, and I think Meryl Streep won for The Iron Lady or something. But, like, no. I'm sorry. You've got your Oscars. Give it to her. She is... Yeah. So, yeah, A Simple Life is about this Otto, about this woman who's in her, like, 70s, I think, and she has been working as a maid, and at the beginning of the film, she has a stroke. And it's not too serious a stroke, but it is a wake-up call to her, and she's like, you know what, I'm going to retire, and I'd like you to put me in a retirement home, a nursing home. And so there's this brief little thing where Andy Lau is going around looking for nursing homes, and he finds his nursing home, who turns out is run, and Andy Lau plays this film producer, this relatively famous film producer, and he finds this place that is run by a friend of his, who is doing it, it seems to just kind of be doing it for a quick buck, because apparently it's very profitable, and you think, when you were first introduced to this nursing home, that, oh no, this is going to be a very depressing film about elder abuse, because, like, look at how these people maybe aren't being treated the best, and it's just, you're just really worried. And then the film turns into what I would call the anti-amour. This is the most humane, sweet, loving, rich film that I've ever seen about, like, maybe outside of Ingmar Bergman's Wild Strawberries, about people in, like, the last years of their life.
Yeah. And what I appreciate about A Simple Life is that it actually does have elements of both of those things, where we get to see that the nursing home, not really the best place. You know, she has her own room, but it's really, like, a cubicle in this big open space.
Right, they live in cubicles.
Yeah. Like, they look like office cubicles. They're made of that same material. And, you know, we get to sort of look around at all of the people in this home. And, you know, it looks pretty miserable. There's, like, a shot where a nurse is, like, feeding a whole line of old people who are having trouble feeding themselves. And she's just going down person to person, sort of putting things in their mouths. And it seems really cold and impersonal. And, you feel this sort of, like, deep abiding sadness in that moment. Oh, God, this woman is just going to be, she's been a servant her whole life, and she's just going to be cast aside into this uncaring and cold, sterile environment full of cubicles. And all of that, all of those pangs are still there. And yet the Andy Lau character, he's not like disgusted or outraged by it, but he does want to sort of offer her something else, and it's her acceptance of wherever she's going to go and his care for her wherever she is where a lot of actual humanity starts to blossom, and we get to understand that this is not necessarily about the end of her life or sort of a period to her sentence. It's not the end of her story. It's the story is slowly revealing over the course of the movie the depth of care and relationship that these two people have, and how, and the relationship between these two people is weirdly a lot more intimate than even family can provide.
Right.
The particular circumstances of how they've known each other over the years and how they've cared for each other over the years, even going back to when he was a boy, and how Otto would like sneak him sodas and stuff, proves to be a kind of caring that is almost deeper than family, and is different than a relationship, like different than a friendship and different than a romance. It is this sort of like ersatz mother-son relationship that seems a lot more caring and knowing than a different type of relationship.
Right.
And what's revealed and how this relationship is revealed is the care that Roger puts into it.
Right.
That he is unwilling to...
He becomes the caretaker. And a really, really, really good caretaker. Like, one could hope to have a man as kind and caring as Andy Lau's Roger.
And this isn't like he's only caring for her because he has the financial means. He's pretty wealthy. He's, you know, comes from a rich family.
Comes from a very wealthy family.
Yeah, we get to see sort of like what they do during the holidays, and they're all pretty well moneyed. And he's not the type of rich person to just sort of provide money and that's all, because he has it and he can provide it. He's actually trying to very thoughtfully figure out how to care for and be with this person who means so much to him. And I think that he is willing to go the distance reveals a lot about Otto and all of the things that she has put into this. So every time she brings up something about the past or something about herself, we're seeing a so much deeper portrait of who she is and the kind of person she is and how she's come to be such a deeply compassionate person who is not oppressed and who is not facing death with an element of tragedy. She is sort of revealing over the course of this movie how, oh gosh, I'm being inarticulate just because of how deeply emotional this movie is. Just what a complete human being she really is.
There's so many little, like, there's so many little moments, and I know that I've forgotten a lot of them already, and it just, that just tiny little things in this movie that just feel like the biggest things in the world. Like, there's a scene where at the beginning of the film, Andy Lau, who he needs to change his diet for the better, but he really loves, I think it's ox tongue.
There's a scene where he and a bunch of buddies share this like really rich piece of meat.
Right, and it's the ox tongue that she was cooking right before she had her stroke at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
And so they're finally having it, and they get on a phone call with her, and she remembers all of their names, and it's just the sweetest thing. But also there's just little humorous moments where there's a running gag where Andy Lau really likes this, you know, this very simple blue coat, this jacket that looks like the kind of jacket that a plumber or an electrician would wear. And so there's a running gag throughout the movie where people keep thinking that, like, hey, you, I called you 3 hours ago. Why haven't you gotten here? It's like, who are you talking about? It's like, you're the electrician, right? He's like, no, I'm not. or people think that he's a taxi driver. It's like, dude, your taxi's just sitting out there. And he's like, no, I'm an electrician. Don't you understand? And just these little tiny moments. And then the last 15 minutes of the movie, where, you know, the inevitable is going to happen. And you're wondering how this movie that has been so sweet but also hasn't pulled punches when it comes to, you know, Otto's friends passing away. And, like, how is this movie going to resolve? What's going to be the emotional climax? And it gets a little almost abstract and surreal, and where we kind of move through these beats that you would expect to be huge.
Mm-hmm.
Like, here's the big emotional climax, and it just kind of, time skips along, and you just get these little tiny snippets of these big moments. And yeah, and it felt, up until the credits begin to roll, when it gets maybe a bit supernatural, and it's not how you expect the film to end.
Yeah, well, but I think that's another strength of the movie. Rather than going through sort of the big melodramatic beats and the big weepy farewells, you know, the last scene they have together is just Andy Lau sort of, she's had, you know, in very ill health at this point. She needs to be strapped into a wheelchair. She can barely speak because she's so infirm. And they're just sort of walking through a park, and he like gets up to throw something away in a trash can. And it's like that might have been like sort of the moment of her death. Like, we don't actually see it happen.
Well, yeah, the last time they see each other, she is just unconscious in a bed.
Mm.
And Andy Lau is going away on like a business trip, and he just,
but what he says is, like, if she dies while I'm away, just keep her in the morgue and I'll take care of the funeral stuff. There's a scene earlier where he's talking with a relative about how...
it's his sister.
He's talking with his sister about how, you know, it's sort of like she always loved you best conversation. But then the sister says, I really admire that you've been taking care of her and looking after her and paying for all this stuff. So just to sort of even it out between us, I'll pay for her funeral when she dies. And Andy Lau doesn't like get really sort of taken aback. Oh, God, we're talking about her death. You know, this is actually a sweet thing. None of that. They're looking at this from a very practical perspective, and they understand that this is inevitable. And I appreciate that the film looks at death and the death industry in a very practical sort of way, and how the connections you're making with them as a person need to be taken care of, whereas the practical stuff is just the practical stuff. It sort of like takes all of that stuff in stride. In another film, it would have been maybe a more melodramatic moment where they're talking about where we get to sort of linger on her death and see the final moments and focus on sort of the sadness that he feels. But we, at that point in the movie, we know the sadness he feels, and we know that they've made this connection and they're both a little bit at peace with what's about to happen.
Right.
It's not about denial. That's a very Western thing, this sort of life versus death, rather than life and death being part of the same process.
Right. And it's also not going to just smother your face in misery like Michael Haneke's Amour.
and don't get me wrong, I love being smothered in misery. I think that's a fine experience.
And I think Amour is a great movie, but also, oh my word. I saw that as a double feature with... When I saw Amour, when the film, the credits ended, I pressed play on Pop Star Never Stop, Never Stopping. That was my double feature.
All right.
That is maybe the weirdest double feature I have ever done.
From the sublime to the ridiculous. All right.
And
what sort of high did you get after that? That's got to be weird.
I'll tell you what. I didn't have a great time with Pop Star Never Stop, Never Stopping, and it's probably mostly because just finished Amour. But I just wanted to see if I could do it. Like, I could see what would happen, if the universe would implode. Anyway, that was like a couple years ago, but just, yeah, A Simple Life it hit me really, really hard because I have lost several grandparent figures in the past six months or so, and I'm in the process of losing more, and it's just, watching this movie was just like, oh, life is beautiful, isn't it? It's just so beautiful, and the fireworks, like, it's got, like, firework scenes can be so cliche, and this one, the firework scene in this one is just divine.
Yeah, there's, I was reminded of, and I hope this isn't a crass comparison, but I was reminded of Richard Linklater's film Boyhood,
Okay.
Which is, you know, that's a film about sort of growing up. It's about the start of life. But there's something that happened in Boyhood where it was after the main character's high school graduation. The film was made over the course of 12 years from when he's 7 to when he graduates high school. And it's this really brief scene where he comes in and he's just sort of wearing the gown, the graduation gown. It doesn't fit him very well. He's holding his diploma. He's just sort of like shuffling into the kitchen. It's like the most ordinary, awkward scene. And his parents are both there and they just sort of want to take a picture with him. And you recall scenes like that from your own life, probably, when you graduated high school or when you completed something and your parents are so proud and they want to take pictures. And it seems kind of like a dry, boring experience at the time. It's like you've achieved it. You want to kind of celebrate a little bit. But when you watch it in a movie like Boyhood and you've actually been growing up with this kid and you've been seeing him from his parents' perspective and you see what they have been getting through all of these years, that moment takes on a bit of profundity where there's something really important about this little boring, dry, cliched moment in a life of taking a picture of you in a graduation gown in a kitchen. You actually, from Boyhood, understand all of the life that led to that moment. And I feel like that's something...
I saw Boyhood with my family the summer after I graduated and before I went to college. So that moment in particular, and just the ending of that... I also love Boyhood. I know that it's kind of it's cool to like it, but it's also cool to not like Boyhood. but I would like to say that I love Boyhood. I can understand where people make critiques of it, and I understand it. But also, are you kidding me? I saw that movie at the perfect time to see that movie, so it hit me.
Yeah, I adored it as well. I'm a booster for Boyhood, but that element of understanding the life that led up to a very seemingly minor moment, but something that actually feels enormous in the course of the film is something I got a lot from A Simple Life, where sitting up in bed and watching a fireworks show is hugely significant. When I was a young kid, I would be around Christmas time, would be taken around to retirement homes by my church, and we would sing Christmas carols for the people who lived at nursing homes who didn't have families coming to visit them.
Oh, that scene! Oh my word!
Yeah, there's a scene in A Simple Life where they're at the retirement home, and they bring in pets and they bring in a pop singer of some kind. And then they
say, okay, totally not interested to be there.
Yeah. Who clearly doesn't want to be there. And then, when she leaves, they're like, okay, that's good. We're done. We saw pets. We saw a pop star. We got to say, no, we got one more visit. And a bunch of kids flood in. And like you can see the old people. Well, it's like, okay, let's do this
cookies
as well.
And like, they put it on video. Like they give out like treats or like food. And then once the cameras stop rolling, like, we have to take those back. You'll get a box of them in like a week or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, for real. But we have to take these back so we can give them to the next retirement home. And it's just like, oh my word.
Like, there's something really cold about that, but there's also something really kind of human about that process, because we actually have come to see what those kinds of visits mean to those people who are living there, and how it is incredibly significant, but also kind of boring, like, and there's like a kind of connection going on. I sensed a lot of actual humanity in a scene like that, where something that is dull and commonplace was given its due as sort of a functional thing, and we are kind of reminded why we do those sorts of things. But not from like a really cynical perspective. It's actually from a very humane perspective.
A Simple Life is it's spectacular. Like,
it's so good.
It really is. I also saw, this isn't on Ovid, but I saw the Anne Hui film that just was released by Criterion.
Okay.
Boat People from 1982. It's I think it's her fifth film.
Okay.
Her fifth feature, and that was the it seems that every year Criterion releases a film like on my birthday. Okay. Last year it was Joyce Chopra's Smooth Talk with Laura Dern, okay, which I also saw for the first time, and I don't want to ever see that movie again, but it's great. and then Boat People was that film this year. And it's a, first of all, it's a great film. It's about a Japanese photographer, journalist who comes to Vietnam, and this is, I think, like 7 years after the war has ended, the American war in Vietnam, and Vietnam is very eager to show this Japanese photojournalist all of how things are amazing now. And as he just goes off on his own, he realizes that maybe things aren't so great, and maybe there's a lot of human rights violations going on. And it's a film about the refugee crisis from the perspective of this photojournalist who is trying to help these kids, these young kids, get out. And that film is a very, very political movie. It's a film from a Hong Kong filmmaker shot in China, about a Japanese photojournalist in Vietnam. Like, the entire cast is Chinese, and the film is in Cantonese. And the film is kind of, you can watch it and totally kind of see it as anti-communist propaganda. Okay. I guess it would function, but then you also take into account that the last film that An Hui had made had been a film eviscerating how capitalism is harming the Vietnamese refugees. And so, anyway, this is to say that you should go read Justin Chang's essay that he wrote for the film Boat People, which is an amazing essay, and it really helped me kind of sort out my feelings about the film, because I wasn't really sure when I had finished. It's like, there is some... it's amazing filmmaking, and it's really emotional, and it works. And I like, kind of similar to what we were talking about in regards to Which Way Is East, Notebooks from Vietnam, how maybe the camera and this outsider coming in and documenting maybe isn't what Vietnam needs. And that ultimately what's important is people. And a person's life will always be more valuable than a photo that gets people to invest in, you know, Vietnamese refugee. Like, it will always be more important to save the refugee than to get a good photo and tell the world about the human rights violations, is kind of the message of the film. And I feel like that's a very subversive, and where the film goes is it kind of basically essentially critiques the audience, which we are. This photojournalist is our entry into the film. And it ultimately, the film says, it's like, you're not needed. And so I would really recommend that people also seek out, it's on Criterion Channel, and Hui's Boat People. It's a very different film from A Simple Life, but
yeah, well, and
what I've gathered from seeing these two films is just that An Hui, regardless of maybe the politics or the class issues, that An Hui's just very, very focused on retaining the humanity of her characters, no matter what. And it results in just emotionally rich films. And so, yeah.
That message, that's actually really interesting, this message that the journalist is useless in sort of actual human rights violations, because
He serves a function, but the function is not what he came to do. I don't want to say what happens, but just the film ends up saying is like, yeah, the journalist part is actually the least important reason of why he's here. It's not about making him a better person and then being able to leave and forget about it. It's not like we talked about with Lynn Sachs. It's not just about a person goes on travel, learns a valuable lesson, and is better for it regardless of what happened to the actual people who are actually suffering. It is about, no, the important thing is about helping the people who are suffering.
Okay. Yeah, the idea that we're sort of living in this age of information now in 2022, and we like to feel a good, we as modern Americans like to feel a good deal of pride in merely being informed, but you know, unless that information is leading to no action whatsoever, what's the point of being informed? Like, how have you changed as a person? That's interesting. I mean, I like that concept.
So that's what we've seen on Ovid this month. Yeah. I actually did see 7 short films that are in a collection of Oscar. These were from the National Film Board of Canada, which we spent 2.5 hours talking about 35 of their shorts. These are specifically 7 of their shorts that won the Oscar for Best Animated Short Film. And I saw those, but Whitney didn't. And we've decided to be, it's been a very busy, particularly busy month of your life.
Most of my months are pretty busy, but this one's been pretty busy.
So what we're going to do is we're going to push those to next month, and next month we're going to be talking about, right around the time of the Oscars, these Oscar-winning short films, and then if I manage to see them, I know you will, but if I manage to find them, we'll talk about the ones that are also nominated for Oscars this year.
Which, as of today, if you... They're being released
in theaters. The nominations are out.
Yeah, they're out in theaters in certain areas as of our recording today. So yeah, you should be able to see, if you're listening to this episode new, then you should be able to see them.
Yeah. But so that's, I think, what we're doing next month. That's pretty much it. Thanks for doing this.
Well, thank you. Thanks for always pushing me to stay on this and watching these interesting movies, because it's always rewarding. You know, as we've said before, there aren't a lot of duds. We can complain about Ovid, but you know, we're not gonna. Their selection outweighs any kind of technical foibles I might have with the streaming service. What we do is talk about it so more people get on the streaming service, and then they have a lot more money, and then they can upgrade all of their technology. So we're really doing a service after all.
And yeah, that's pretty much it after this. If you'll excuse me, I'm off to read. I got 2 books for my birthday. I finally have my very own James Baldwin novel.
Oh, nice.
I'm reading Another Country. I've read several other of his, like that I checked out from the library or whatever. And I finally got Selected Works by Audre Lorde.
Oh, nice.
I've never read Audre Lorde, and I'm finally going to get to read Audre Lorde.
Yeah, nor have I. I'll keep me updated.
And then I'm also going to go watch the second half of Children of Paradise, because I saw the first half and I really loved it, but it was really late and so I couldn't finish it, and now I'm finally going to watch the second half. I know it's one of your favorites.
It's one of the best movies ever made. That's not hyperbole. It's simply one of the best movies ever made. And it luckily it's handily split. It was sort of presented in 2 halves. So, when you start the second half, they give you the titles again, and you hear the same drum beat as it opens up. So, there's an intermission. You can see it as 2 movies if you want to. So, there's no grievous error in turning it off at halfway through.
I saw the first half, and I really, really liked it, the most of it. And then the pantomime stuff itself...
Uh-huh.
Oh my word, it's spectacular. Oh my word. It's like magic. It's like, man, why haven't I seen this in more stuff? This is amazing. it's so beautiful. Like the relation stuff is, you know, it's very well done and stuff, but like this pantomime, oh my word. So anyway. All right. Whitney, real quick, let's plug our other stuff. So you have a Critically Acclaimed Network.
I have a Critically Acclaimed Network. It's a little trim this week just because of, you know, all those busyness reasons. With one William Bibbiani, I am part of the Critically Acclaimed Network, where we review new films and new TV shows. We recently kind of resurrected one of our shows that had been on hiatus called Canceled Too Soon, where we talk about TV shows that have been canceled, that only lasted 1 season or less. We talked about a show called Perpetual Grace Limited, which is a very peculiar and very interesting show. And we have many other shows besides devoted to Star Trek and Batman and the Academy Awards. I have a podcast called All About Ovid, which I do with B. Peterson. It's really interesting. Oh. You should listen to that one.
I just want to say thank you, by the way, for you plugged the Linsax episodes on a lot of podcasts, like a lot of your episodes.
Well, a lot of our podcasts go to like different like tiers within our Patreon. We have a Patreon you can subscribe to. So I wanted to make sure everyone on every tier got at least a message of it. So I think I put it on every single one of those.
Yeah.
So
thanks for that. And then, yeah, you also write for Slash Film, where you are smuggling Walt Whitman essays into stuff about Eternals.
They asked me. I got to write an article about sort of hints in a Marvel movie. Is here's Eternals, and here's how they could have revealed the plot. But it turns out it was a Walt Whitman quote, so I went in kind of deep on Walt Whitman. I got to do an article.
And you just wrote a whole article about Lav Diaz. What?
And yeah, they let me write an article about Lav Diaz
Slash
over
Film
there.
Slash Film of all places.
Yeah, Slash Film's very like Star Wars Marvel centric. It's all very poppy, but yeah, they kind of let you follow your brain a little bit. I appreciate the leeway they've been giving me. And yeah, here recently I wrote an article on Corpse Bride, the Tim Burton animated film, and it turns out it's inspired by a story of ancient Jewish mysticism. So I got to sort of look up grave sites of like 15th century Talmudic scholars and write about that
and this
essay about Corpse Bride that I'm writing. So I'm glad that they kind of let me follow my bizarre brain where it has a tendency to go.
All right. As for me, Twitter, Letterboxd, at Blue Gray Closet. I just wrote a whole thing about my submissions for the Sight and Sound poll. Mm-hmm. If I did it, and I'm proud. I pick some very good movies, I must say. It's just very good movies.
You know what? We'll be selected someday, both you and I. We're going to be polled by Sight and Sound at some point, and so it's good to have your list at the ready just in case.
Yes. And then, yeah, that's pretty much it. We'll be back next month. Thanks for listening, because we know that there's a pull these days when it comes to films to focus only on the big and the mainstream stuff. So thanks for spending time with us today here on The Margins. Good afternoon.